Today's date is July 17th, 1997. The speaker is Jim DeLange. The subject is community. The need for a church community in the lives of gay, lesbian, and bisexual people.
You know, in dealing with that, that it's always a problem. And I think that the question always is this the work of the church? You know, that how do we view this? Just by way of introduction, for those of you who don't know me, I'm Jim DeLange. I'm the pastor at St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco. And I have been talking this week mostly about gay and lesbian issues, but I told the staff that I thought that they asked what kinds of things I could teach, and I said I thought I could teach something about church property and about the way that we manage that property. So that's what I want to talk about tonight, and you can go ahead and roll the tape. There are several ways of looking at your church buildings. One is that that they are religious buildings. And that these buildings are dedicated to the worship of God and for the promotion of the Christian faith, and that these church buildings are to be used for no other purpose than for that. And that the buildings belong to the congregation, if you will, to the members of the congregation for their use, and that that's if someone else wants to use the building, why that has to be approved, and we have to kind of look at that, and we have to be careful about how it is that that is used. And most of all, when someone else wants to use the building, we want to be sure we count the spoons. That's the critical thing. Secondly, another view of it is that our church buildings are to be public buildings. And that as public buildings, that they are available while it is owned by the congregation, why the congregation is but one organization that is using the building, and that the rest of the community or whatever else it is to be made available to them, that if it is in keeping with the ministry of the congregation. And secondly, that the public use of these buildings, of our buildings, is to be used as a income resource for us to be able to carry on the ministry of our congregation. This is the view that says that congregations basically use their church building for worship and for confirmation and for Sunday school, and on Sunday morning, in the rest of the time, except for a few church meetings and so on like that, that's why it's to be made available to the public. And what we are to do is that we are to be sort of benevolent, if you will, and beneficent landlords, in which we make our building available to the public, especially to nonprofit groups. Another view is to say it's both. All right, we are a church that worships God, and we are dedicated to the promotion of the gospel and the extension of the gospel. And this is what many congregations have done, and is a constant source of conflict between the public use of the buildings and the congregation's use. And so you have the situation where the person in the congregation, it's usually a woman, who has custody of the kitchen. Every congregation has one of these people. And the person who takes personal responsibility for the kitchen. And it's usually illustrated by when someone wants to come into the kitchen, this person is standing there like this. And kind of with an attitude, what do you want? What are you looking for? You know, this is sort of my territory. And the person in the congregation that has that feeling about not just the kitchen, but the person that has that feeling about other meeting rooms and so on, like this, the Sunday school rooms or what have you, has the same kind of custodial view of the building. And there's always something missing. You know, and whenever there's something missing, it must be those Methodists who are using the church on Sunday afternoon, or it's that AA group that's coming in and using up our coffee. And I'll bet they're the ones that took the spoons too. And always, it's always seems, never the knives and forks, it's always the spoons. So there's always this kind of conflict. What congregations, I believe, need to recognize is that they have two major resources for doing the work of the kingdom in as a Christian congregation. The number one resource is their people. You can be a congregation without having a building, but you can't be a congregation without having people. But most congregations not only have people, they also have buildings. And they need to be, their real estate needs to be looked upon as a resource for ministry, as a tool and a resource for ministry, just as the people in the congregation are. In some cases, of course, the real estate owns the people in heavily indebted congregations. What has developed in the last few years, not only in the cities, but also throughout suburban places, is that as we have become more and more populated, and people have become more and more and more in need to meet together, because we have a more egalitarian society as far as solving community problems, there is more and more a need for community meeting space. Also, the development, whether you're in a suburban community or wherever you are, the actual explosion of 12-step recovery groups for Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous, all of these 12-step kinds of groups, which are doing absolutely marvelous and wonderful work, that the demand for meeting space in large groups is really necessary. And if you live in a gated community or something akin to that, and you have a community center in that, or you live in a mobile home park or something like that, community center gets a lot of use, and it's always a great deal of competition for use. Well, in the city, most people live in small apartments, less than 1,000 square feet. Most people, or if they live in houses, they are not very big houses. And so the need for community space where 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or up to 100 people can meet is very, very necessary. So I'm going to just tell you what it is that we've done at our church. Some of you heard this history, and some of you have not, but St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco is a merger of two ethnic Scandinavian churches. A Danish Lutheran church that was founded in 1903, and a Finnish church that was founded in 1890. And the two congregations ended up about 50 yards apart, and were that way for about 30 years, and their diminishing membership out of survival, they decided to merge in 1964. Now, the American Lutheran Church, to which the New St. Francis Church, which they just changed the name, they just took the corporate structure of one of the congregations and changed the name to St. Francis Lutheran Church, and they all deeded their properties, their two properties that they own, their two churches, into this new corporation. That's how they did it legally. But what the American Lutheran Church asked them to do at the time of the merger was to sell one of the properties and to turn the money over to the American Lutheran Church. That was what happened with a lot of inner city mergers in the 60s and so on like that. Well, it was very, very common because then that money then, for these merged congregations, that money then would be released. The idea was it would be made available then to start a new church out in the suburbs where people were moving. Well, this congregation decided not to do that. They decided to hang on to both pieces of property, and they did it for a reason at the time that made sense to them. And that was because in the merger of these two congregations, the old Danish church had been having services exclusively in English for many, many years. But the Finnish congregation had had services in Finnish and in English every Sunday for years. So they decided to do is to put all of the English-speaking services over onto into the old Danish church, and to put all of the, and then they would continue to have Finnish services over in the old Finnish church. So for the Finnish-speaking Finns, if you would, they didn't see any difference in the merger, and they still had their church and everything else like this that they had. When I came in 1981, they were still holding services in Finnish for four people twice a month on a Sunday afternoon. Anyway, these buildings that we have, one was built in 1905, and that's the former Danish church. It was dedicated 12 days before the 1906 earthquake and fire, and was used as a hospital and a way station during the earthquake of 1906. That building is today a San Francisco landmark. It was declared a landmark in 1971. That means that we cannot make any modifications to the exterior of that building without the permission of the City and County of San Francisco and the Landmark Commission. And if you live in any kind of a place where there's landmarking going on, you know that's a big controversy, because sometimes they landmark buildings that, preservationists can be extremely doctrinaire. And in San Francisco, there was, like there was in many cities, the demolition that took place in the 50s and 60s of buildings that were part of its cultural heritage was absolutely a travesty. And so San Francisco is pretty adamant about trying to preserve its architectural heritage. But we're not unique in that in some cities. The other building, the Finnish church, was built in 1936. And it's actually a larger piece of property. It's on three city lots, and the Danish church is on two city lots. Very wisely, the people in the 1960s bought, in 1968, they bought a building that was next door to the Danish church. And that building was built in 1890. It's the oldest of the buildings. This building was built in 1936, and this building was built in 1905-06. So this building that they purchased in 1968 was actually older than the rest of them. Well, the problem, of course, that you have with buildings of this age is that, first of all, they didn't have the building materials at that time or the building techniques, and you have all kinds of problems that just go with having a building that's old.
Where'd you get the money to buy them in 68?
In 1968, where did they get the money? I think somebody left them a small legacy. Somebody willed them a small amount of money, and they had enough money to buy this building, and then they borrowed the rest. And when I came in 1981, they had a loan on it. It was a bad loan with a high rate of interest, something like that. But anyway, that's another story. Since 1981, when I came to this congregation, we are what the ELCA calls a rerooted congregation. There were some wonderful people that were there at the time, about 30 or 40 people. But today, of our 160 members, many of those folks have died because they were elderly at the time. And I would say that of our 160 members, probably a dozen or so are there who were there when I came in 1981. So we're essentially a new congregation. And this happens frequently in urban areas where that happens with congregations. I will say that the people, and I've said this in a previous class, I will say that when I came there in 1981, the people who were there, many of whom were in their 70s and 80s, were absolutely wonderful people, and they did not care who came through the door. They were just glad to have you there. And they treated me that way, and they treated everybody else who came in that way. And a couple of those folks are still around, but most of them have passed away. After I was there a year or two, the leadership and I sat down and asked what we could do with these resources that we had. What would be the best use of them? In the previous dozen years or so, the buildings had been looked upon as a way to either do an extension of the church's ministry or to be provide opportunities for low-income people to get back on their feet, this kind of thing. So the properties were utilized as, if you will, as kind of an extension of how the church saw itself as an inner-city congregation. So a child care center was started in 1977, geared primarily to low-income families, single-parent families, some of whom had parents, there were children whose parents were incarcerated in the prison. And so you had a cooperative corporation was set up between the church and an organization called Friends Outside, which is still in existence in some places today, which is for Friends Outside, which is outside of prison. That's what it means. And it was an organization to help families of people who had one of the parents in prison. And that is the heritage of the child care center. The child care center had free rent and was carried on the insurance policy of the church and was just basically subsidized in that way. And that was the only way that they could make it. The other thing is that there was a thrift shop that was operated in out of one of the parts of the building next door, and the profits from that were to go for the support of the child care center. Friends Outside also had offices with minimal rent. A member of the church operated a restaurant in one of the spaces in the building next door, which was done with he had a sweetheart deal as far as a lease was concerned. What we did as new people came in, and it was a younger generation of people, and there were a group of people that were already there, and we sat down and we just kind of said, now what is it we want to do here in the next few years? And what is it going to take for us to be able to do it? And what are the resources that we have? And we decided on a policy, and that was that the property that we owned was a resource that was to be operated as a business, and it would have a separate budget. A separate committee would supervise the management of these properties, so that the council, every council meeting, all we did was talk about property issues. solving it. I mean, some of you have had that experience too. And every council meeting, it was all about property. We never got talking about ministry. By the time we did, everybody was tired and wanted to go home. So we used to have a separate property committee, and the property committee would be elected by the council. But two members of the council would sit on the property committee. So we have a property committee of six people, four elected by the council, and two people from the council appointed to it. So there's four people outside. And they would be selected on the basis of the fact that whether or not they owned property, because in San Francisco, almost everyone's a tenant. And so this would be people who owned property, understood this, or at one time had, and people who, in some cases, if possible, were landlords. The committee was authorized to spend up to $3,000 on any improvement or repair or anything else like this without going to the council. So you didn't have this long delay of, you know, a month before a decision could be made when a toilet broke or something like that. The other thing was that we would appoint one of the staff members. In this case, it was the secretary of the congregation, someone who was on site all the time, who previously been our sexton, who would be a staff to the committee, with the pastor as a backup. There's a recognition that if you are going to manage church properties and manage them well, you have to have someone on site. And if the only person to do that is the pastor, well, so be it. Either that or you have to hire somebody if the pastor isn't going to do it. Use of the church building itself. This building here, which we used for worship, that building would be available to outside groups, as would, of course, the other buildings. But any church activity, any church-related activity, would take priority over some community scheduled meeting as a policy. And what we would try to do is negotiate the use of the space and maybe move them to another space or try to accommodate. But the bottom line was we were not going to compromise our program for the church by some outside group that needed to use it. And that required some planning. The other thing was is that this 1936 building, the social hall in the old Finnish church, which had been converted to a child care center, that the integrity of that space, operated by the child care center 12 hours a day, 7 days, 5 days a week, would be theirs for their exclusive use, and anyone that wanted to use it in the evening hours or anything else would have to negotiate with the child care center for its use. We weren't going to do that. And that had to be very clear. Well, this building here, none of these buildings are very big, but this building here that was purchased in 19 has four large apartments, or they're actually flats, and two restaurants. And when I mean restaurants, these are narrow spaces that are probably, they're about 1,100 square feet. They're not very big. This building here was a sanctuary, and the social hall, I guess I should write this on this side. Sanctuary and social hall, which occupied which is where the child care center was. And in this building, we had a sanctuary, a large hall, and a couple of meeting rooms that we used, as well as an apartment that previously had been where the pastor lived, but for many years had been occupied by the church sexton, the caretaker who lived on the premises. Well, what we did was that when we started operating this way, while the thrift shop, in very, very soon thereafter, went out of business, not because of our policy, it just did of its own volition. So what we did was that we rented that space out to a restaurant, and we charged market rent. The sweetheart deal that the church member had with his burrito restaurant, takeout restaurant. He was also charged market rent and was given a commercial lease rather than just sort of a handshake. And the four large flats were, as the tenants, current tenants vacated, those were remodeled and fixed up, new kitchens put in, and we borrowed the money to do that, and they were then rented at market rate.
What's market rate out there?
Those large flats now rent for around $1,300 a month. That's what they rent for.
That's a deal.
And that's a deal, yeah. There's a less than 1% vacancy rate in San Francisco right now. The market was soft for a lot of years, but it's tightened up again. The other thing that we did was that we opened up our building, our regular church building, to 12-step groups and community meetings. And we put a sliding scale together of what to charge these 12-step groups on the basis of the size of their group. So if you were a group of less than 12, you paid like $30 a month. It'd meet once a week for an hour and a half. If you were a group that was from 15 to 25, you pay, I think, $60 a month. And if it's over 25, you pay, I don't know what it is. Anyway, I forget what the scale is. I don't keep track. The secretary does. But anyway, we have groups that are all the way up to 90, up to 75 or 80 people. If you're over 75, I know they pay $90 a month. And we have a couple of groups that meet every day, 12-step groups. And they pay a different rate. But we have a regular scale that we figured out. We now have about 35 or 40 12-step groups that use the facility, this here. We have an obligation, we feel, to those groups, which is that, number one, we promised them a clean space. So we have a custodian, the hired custodian, that cleans up and makes sure that the place is always in shape, that light bulbs are changed, you know, that they know how to turn the heat on, that they have storage space for their books and pamphlets and things like this, and that, most importantly, the bathrooms are always clean and supplied with paper. And we pay for those supplies. Also, we make available to them our coffee pots. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that we don't want them hauling and storing coffee pots in here. So we make our coffee pot available to them, but they have to bring in their own coffee in their own cups and stuff like that. And when those coffee pots break, we don't say they broke them. We go out and buy another one. You know, 30 cupper. They usually use a 30 cupper. And that's just part of what it means to be in business. The other thing is that we may have locks on all the kitchen cabinets, and only a few people have keys to those cabinets. And so if something comes in, and if something is missing from those cabinets, the spoons are missing, it's because somebody left the cabinet unlocked, and we have only ourselves to blame. But we have an understanding like that with the groups. Also, we communicate with them. Once a year or so, we go and talk to them and say, you know, we're glad to have you here, and we believe in what it is that you are doing, and we see this as an extension of our ministry. And what it is that they pay to us for the use of the facility, we look upon as a sort of a compensation for utilities and our supply and stuff like that. But the Chase is in high demand, yes.
Did you, and I'm looking at it as a business, did you have a breaking point where you could provide those services and not lose money? Had you got that figured out? We had a goal set? We tried that before, but we haven't come out ahead on it. That's because we haven't had enough groups that have signed up.
Yeah, well, that's some of it is you have in the bond. But of course, you know, the fewer groups you have, the less that they use.
Less work.
Yeah, the less paper supply.
But you still have to hire a custodian no matter what the, you know.
Yes, of course. Of course, I contend that you have to hire a custodian anyway.
Yeah.
because you want to have, if you want to have your church look welcoming to visitors, you better have your place look clean. I mean, I've walked into church bathrooms and church kitchens, and I turned around and walked out. I wouldn't use the bathroom. And the way that congregations often feel about this is, well, it's our family, you know, it's just sort of like the family toilet at home, you know, the family bathroom. It gets a little messy once in a while, and we don't care, we're family. Well, the church is a public building. And when people come in, they get an impression about it, whether or not you care for it. And one of the things with our building is that it's a very simple and modest building, because the Danish people who built it at the turn of the century didn't have very much money. But it's an honest building. And so we keep it painted, and we keep it in shape, and we set aside so much a year. But let me tell you what this has resulted in, this use of our buildings. How are we doing on time? Oh, all right. For the property, we have a budget. We have a fiscal year budget that goes from July 1 to June 3rd. And our budget for this next year is $181,000. That's just for the property. Out of that, the income is from all of the rentals. We realize we charge the child care center. We started charging the child care center rent. We charge them a little over $12,000 a year in rent. And the mission and ministry side of our budget, which is this whole separate budget from this, we give them a grant of $12,000 a year. So in other words, the money is shifted, but they pay rent. But the congregation sees that what it is that we're doing for that child care center is part of the mission of the church, because it's in the mission budget, the mission section of the budget. It doesn't get lost. out of this $181,000, we have debt service. We do our debt service. Our debt service right now was quite considerable for a number of years, and we cleaned up most of our debt. Our debt service is only $14,000 a year. We have about, those buildings together are worth probably in the neighborhood of $3 million, but the debt service is only this, and that's the advantage that older congregations have, is eventually to pay off their debt. Another big expense is insurance, and that's about $13,000 a year on all of our buildings. We set aside for repairs in this budget. Normally we set aside $12,000 a year just for incidental repairs. Fixing toilets, repair, going in and paint an apartment when it's vacated, things like this. Those kinds of things. Surprises that come up, like we just had replaced the sewer.
Major surprise.
Yeah.
Major surprise.
The sewer alone was $11,000. Well, that's a real budget buster right there. So we have this for what we call incidental repairs. We have to pay property taxes on the part that the building that isn't used for religious purposes. We have to have our cleaning and paper supplies. And of course, utilities. Now we have utilities run around on all the buildings. They run around $15,000 a year. That's for gas and electric, sewer and trash pickup. And the way we worked that is that we only have the restaurants are on their own meters, and so are the four apartments. They pay their own meters. We also have I forgot to mention, in the old Finnish church, we also have the parsonage, which is where two of our associate pastors live. But what we do with the utilities is that we bill the restaurants because there's only one water meter going into the building, and we have to pay the whole water bill. We charge the restaurants 25% of that water bill, each of them. So they pay 50% of their water bill, and then we pay the rest for the other tenants. That's on the building with the restaurants. We have a number of other expenses here that you normally have in doing this, but we operate that. And after we get all through with our expenses relative to the property, we have about $65,000 in profit that we pour into the mission and ministry of the church, of the congregation, for salaries, for program, for all the things that are related to the congregation's life. Our mission and ministry budget is $275,000. That's in addition to this property budget. Well over 50% of that $275,000 comes from contributions. But about $65,000 this next year will be poured into the mission ministry budget for the ministry of the church. And then we project each year that we should have a net profit of something like $20,000, maybe $15,000. But we found with old buildings that we have to have $18,000 in reserve at all times in case something comes up, like new sewer. At the same time the new sewer comes up, we found termites in the building next door. That was $15,000 to do that. So this is the kind of thing that you deal with in inner city churches. It's the only way that we've been able to make our buildings not only pay for themselves for their upkeep, but also to be able to help support the mission and ministry of the congregation. We did a survey among the 12 ELCA congregations in San Francisco a few years ago, and the income from the rent of their buildings was $500,000 a year. Some congregations literally would not survive at all unless they had that income. So anyway, I'll take your questions at this point.
How large a congregation do you have?
About 160 members.
And what's your average worship on Sunday morning?
Excuse me.
That's a shocking question.
It's between 75 and 100. We run. We just have one
service. You have a large service and on two floors.
Yes, we do. We have four pastors, two full-time and two part-time. We have benevolence. Our benevolence is about $40,000. We don't give that, because we've been kicked out of the ELCA, we don't give any money to the ELCA, but we support Lutheran Home Relief and Lutheran Social Services and some things like that.
We have a congregation, my wife and I have about 3,400 in Tempe, Arizona. And they have a program, you know, for child care and AAA, but they charge nothing, you know. Of course, we have a big return, you know, with that many.
That many people, yeah. How many of those are year-round members?
I would say some over half. We're close to ASU, the college.
Oh, yes.
And we have just one pastor.
Just one pastor.
One pastor. You won't have another one.
Well,
one pastor.
He's a working fool.
But he has a music minister that is great.
Okay, yeah. Well, I will tell you what we have, as I was saying, is that our property budget is this. What we call our mission and ministry budget is, as I say, is about $275,000. And probably something about, I think it is about half of that is for salaries and benefits. You know, salaries and benefits for pastors. We have three, as I said, we have four pastors. Two of them are full-time, two of us are full-time. Pastor Zillhart, myself, and Pastor Frost, and Pastor Hiller are part-time. We pay them, I think, $600, $7,200 a year, or is it $9,600 now? Now, about half of this budget comes from offerings, from pledges from our members.
Did you have members leave when you started this supper committee? And you know, the whole philosophy of a church is not an empty business.
No, we didn't. No, we didn't have anybody.
Now, why not? I mean, that seems to be a big issue in a lot of churches.
Well, that's why. I think that's why I brought up a couple of ways of looking at it. And I think you have to talk it out. I mean, you have to talk it out and say, you know, what are the reasons? What do we want to do? And if your buildings, you know, are looked upon as if they are a resource, you know, what would you do if you didn't have the buildings? You know, what are they there for? It does not make any sense to me to have. It shouldn't make any sense to anybody to have a building that sits there and that's used for just a few hours on Sunday morning and a half a dozen hours during the week in the evening for meetings. That's not good stewardship of what God has given us, I don't think. Yeah.
You mentioned, though, that probably by that time or very close to that time when you had that meeting, you really didn't have very many people left from the original congregation.
No, there weren't many folks around, but the ones who were there were certainly involved.
Right, but you didn't have a lot of people who had a big emotional interest in the buildings. You know,
well,
a lot of history. You had a few left.
The four people, when we asked the people we were going to discontinue the finished services and rent, we rented out the former finished church that is rented out to two other congregations, two other churches that don't have a space, one of which burned down. But when we, and they're two small congregations, when we did that, the certainly those people were not happy about that at all.
Right, but instead of having 200 unhappy people, you only had four, or 12, or 20.
Yeah, maybe half. There are still these constant conflicts about these groups that come in and use the church.
Yeah.
I mean, we get this all the time from the members who feel a tremendous ownership of the space. These people are outsiders and they're coming. And I say, this is not a private club. You know, this is what's called a public ministry. It's the same thing that I remember in a congregation I previously served. A woman who came in to me the Sunday after Easter and was all upset about all these people who came to church on Easter Sunday and took communion and sat in spaces that should have, you know, where the members normally sit. Now, she didn't lose her spot. But you know, it's the same thing. You know, hey, are we a private club or are we? Yeah.
I think that's one reason why you had a little better success quickly.
Yeah.
Some other church that has 500 people who have got relatives that belong there for 100 years.
But so. I think you just have to talk it out and say, well, right. You know, we have to do something here, and that's true. I mean, that's not just true in churches. That's true in, I mean, I belong to Rotary. You know, I mean, we've got. So many people who belong to Rotary since 1947, and you know, we changed the policy on the way we charge for meals. Oh, God! You know, I mean, it was just, you're all, but you know, the club has been running an $80,000 deficit because, you know, people only pay when they show up. So, I mean, with those kinds, So if you cater to to sentimentality, I mean, I think that's it. But you have to find a way to accommodate. For example, the four women who were still worshiping in Finnish, there was another Finnish congregation that had split off from this congregation about two decades before. And they were using our other facility once a month, our other sanctuary. So we had a service in Finnish in our Church Street Church for about 20 people once a month. And then we had these four people over in the other church who said, look, you really need this in the Finnish language, come over here with these folks. And that's what they did. But
you were smart enough. You didn't expect the people to accept your idea the first time you proposed it.
Well, it didn't come all whole cloth out of me.
No, I just, the idea, yeah. If you planted the seeds, yeah. So how long did it take for the seeds to grow? Was it 6 months or 2 years?
Well, it didn't take that long. We just had to sit down and say, we have to figure out what we're going to do here. Well, there was also a lot of resentment. I mean, the other side, there was a lot of resentment, like with the thrift store and that was occupying a expensive space and was paying practically nothing. And then this church member who was literally ripping the church off, taking advantage.
So that helped you get your...
Well, yeah. That was the thing. And also, just the changing dynamics of the whole congregation. But when people ask, how are you able, with a congregation of 160 members, to do this, this is one of the ways we do it. The other way is that we make it very clear to people is that this is not to be looked at as a golden goose. These properties. Stewardship is a matter of our need. Whether God doesn't really need our money, but we need to give. And the whole matter of stewardship is another whole thing, is that we give. And people also have a lot of flexibility in their giving. We give them, their pledge has what they give to the church, what they give for the mission ministry of St. Francis, and then they are given a folder with several designated ministries. There's about 15 in there, and they can designate so much a month that they're going to give to each of these things, whether it's World Relief or Shanty Project or whatever it is.
Your giving of your regular members is also very high compared to most churches.
Sure is.
Yes.
We make very clear, you, this is an expectation. You come here and you want to join, you're going to sign up, you're no longer a consumer, you're part of the act. And
I know there's a Lutheran church in Japan that has less than 50 families. They have a budget of over $1 million a year. Figure that out for
family. Yeah. I wonder. The CEO of Toshiba, the CEO of Toyota, the CEO of Mitsubishi.
You got some big companies in San Francisco.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, and our people are good about giving for the most part. I'll tell you, though, I looked at the second quarter statements before I left, and I was not happy. And I sent out a nasty letter. What?
But also, the makeup of our church is so different than the majority of Lutheran churches, because there's very few families with children, and most of the members are, households have two working members, so yeah. That makes a big difference.
Or it's a single person, mm-hmm. And most people are college educated, so they, and of course, it costs a lot to live in San Francisco. You can't get a decent apartment for even a studio for less than $800 a month. So,
a year ago, I was given four cards of four families that weren't in church on Stewardship Sunday and asked to call them on the phone for their pledge.
Yeah.
First family I called, the man didn't belong to the church, his wife did, and I got the man on the phone. And I asked him if he'd be willing to make a pledge. Yeah, okay, $100 a week, is that okay? I said, that's fine, wrote it down.
Yeah, you never know, all you have to do is ask.
Non-member.
Right, all you have to do is ask. That's right, and that's the thing, is that I think people, especially when they first join you, I think they expect to be asked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to ask. I mean, the best thing to do, of course, is what your congregation does, another member of the church asks them rather than the pastor doing it all.
But. Yeah, one thing you didn't mention that I think is kind of interesting, when you see that these various groups come into St. Francis, they have a sense of ownership of the place also. That is really kind of odd. I mean, they are meeting there every week, so they believe that it belongs to them too. And yes.
They get offended when we try to say, well, you know, I need to get in here.
Yeah, but this is our church. Well, this is our place too. So everything, and we got hundreds of people coming through the building every week, all of whom think belongs to them. And there's something good about that.
Yeah,
there's something very good about that.
I mean, it becomes in a community. And people are aware of it, and some people finally decide after 2 years of coming to 12-step meetings in the parish hall to go upstairs and go to church some Sunday. I mean, that happens. We have our bulletin boards around and with the pictures of all the members of the church up there, and so people can, I mean, that, you know, there's this subtle message, you know.
You better not invite all the groups to church on the same Sunday, though.
No, we don't. Well, some of them are really, really anti-church. I mean, some of the people, you overhear some of the things, and they're really, really angry, really angry.
But it's a heavy populated area of San Francisco, so I mean,
every part of San Francisco is heavily populated.
Yes.
It's 7 miles wide and 7 miles long. Yeah. Everything's compact. So, and we're located where there's on the center a place where there's a lot of streetcar lines. So we have a lot of streetcars back, and it's good, and a lot of foot traffic. So I mean, you have to kind of look at it from the standpoint of your market as to where you are located to be able to do that. But I think, you know, I think the first thing has to go is kind of a mentality and say, who are we here for? Marty used to say years ago, the church exists for those who are not its members.
What percentage of urban Lutheran churches do you think have actually closed their doors in the last 30 years?
Well, in our city, we've lost more than half. But still, we're about three blocks from Mission Dolores, one of the original California missions. You know, was founded by the Franciscans, the whole chain of missions that goes from San Diego up to Sonoma. So it's we're just a couple blocks from Mission Dolores. And the pastor there at Mission Dolores did a survey for his parish, and within a 6-block radius there were 29 churches. Six blocks, and he goes around. You know, and the closest Catholic parish isn't that far out of that 6-block.
Well, didn't they close a bunch of the Catholic churches too in the last 10 years?
Close. Have had to do that. You know.
How many Lutheran churches are there in San Francisco?
I did the other night. I think I said 18. That includes Missouri Synod. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There had been more than 40. Yeah. But as I mentioned in my first one of my earlier talks, is that San Francisco is unique. The Lutheran churches in San Francisco are unique from the other churches in San Francisco, other churches in California, in that the other Lutheran churches in California were founded primarily by people who came from the Midwest and from the East and came to California in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. In San Francisco, they were founded by people who came directly from Europe in the latter part of the 19th century. And like in many places, like in Chicago and other places, they hung on to that ethnic identity far too long when it was no longer relevant. I mean, the McCarran-Walter Act was passed in 1920, you know, ending the open-door immigration policy of this country. You know, and too many of these churches into the 1960s were still waiting for the immigrants to come through the door. You know, and it was very relevant. It was very relevant that mission to the immigrant population was very relevant for its time. It made a lot of sense. And in all the years I was in Southern California, what we were positioned to do was to gather in the Lutherans who were coming out there to work in aerospace plants from Minnesota and Iowa, Nebraska, you know, Wisconsin, you know, and I mean, I can remember having 55 people in a new member class, 55 people. And I'd start a class, and I'd get halfway through it, and I'd start another one, and have 30 people in that. And that went on for, you know, for a number of years. In 14 years, we went from zero to over 1,000 people. I mean, not 14 years, that happened actually in about 8 years. Yeah. But those days are over.
Do you think the attitude that Jenny was talking about in relationship to the church being a business is being forced to change because of the fact that you can't survive without being a business? You can't survive on just the offerings of the congregation?
Well, yeah, that's true. But in some cases, all the congregation does have are the offerings of the people. I mean, depending on where you're located. That is it. But I think when you start talking about budget management of churches, of congregations, I think it is. I think that what the mistake that churches make is that they operate with the idea that, well, somehow the money will come through, and so they end up every year with a deficit. And that is very discouraging for people you are trying to encourage to have good stewardship. What good is my giving do if every year we end up in the hole?
Because isn't there a church in New York City that rebuilt and built an office building on top of their church?
Well, you're talking about St. Peter's Church in Manhattan, Midtown Manhattan, with City Corp. And that's a whole other. You're talking about multi-millions of dollars that was involved. They didn't build it. City Corp did. City Corp came in, and the church looks like a little City Corp. I mean, that's another old story. if you've ever been to St. Peter's in New York, the guy that did that. But what I think what has to happen is that you have to build in. You have to build church budgets based on what it is that people pledge, and then hold them accountable for their pledges and say, look, we're counting on this. And if we don't make it, it's because the pledges. You mean, why ask for pledges and pledges come in and their pledges are $100,000 and then you set the giving at $120,000 because, hey, that's how much we need. Well, maybe that's how much you need, but that's not how much you got.
Then what's going to happen in East Grand Forks, where people have been flooded out, lost everything?
Well, there's a whole program that ELCA is promoting churchwide is for congregations or groups of congregations to adopt one of these congregations.
I know of one church that has over $500,000 repair bill.
Yeah.
And these people, many of them, have lost their entire business, floated down the river.
My guess is that if the ELCA does its job properly and gets that story out, and I think that's one of the functions of a national church body, is that I think that they will get a pretty healthy response. I don't know that they will get it all. Some of those churches have insurance. But some don't, or they're underinsured. And that's another thing. A lot of churches are underinsured. We had one burned to the ground in a beautiful church that I used to belong to, St. Paul's in San Francisco. And fortunately, they were well insured. They're sitting there with a big hole in the ground and $4.5 million in the bank. But. They'll never be able to build that gorgeous church again. So, all right. Well, thank you very much. You can end the tape.